He told me she had been institutionalized from birth. This was what families were told by their doctors in the middle of the 20th century. Institutionalize the child and move on.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio, and from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, speaking with Carolyn Patterson about her debut novel, The Stone Sister. This award-winning novel is told from three points of view: a father's, a nurse's, and a sister's. Together, they tell the unforgettable story of a child's birth, disappearance, and finally discovery in a home for children with disabilities. The Stone Sister is based on the author's own family history and on the history of Montana's systematically disappeared children. Carolyn, welcome to The Right Question.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited.
Oh, I'm so excited to talk with you. I'm hoping that we can begin this conversation with a reading, with you reading from the author's note, actually, if that's okay with you, at the back of your novel. For listeners, it provides some really astounding context for where this novel came from and how the story was, for my lack of a better word, resurrected. So would you mind?
Okay. This book began with a car trip across the Continental Divide in a Volkswagen van with my father. I was 16, my father was 47. We were headed to Great Falls, Montana, where he had some legal business to attend to, and I was participating in a high school drama meet. As our headlights tunneled through the darkness, I peppered him with questions about his early days with my mother, their romance at the University of Montana, their wedding photographer who put the film in upside down. He told me about their first car trip to San Francisco and my mother's terrible morning sickness. "She must have been pregnant with me," I said. My father cleared his throat. "No," he said, "you have a sister." "Kathleen," I said, referring to my younger sister, already knowing the math didn't work out. "No," he said, "you have another sister." Her name was the same as mine, Carolyn Patterson. Upset and confused, I flooded him with questions. Where was she? Had he seen her? Could we go see her? He told me she had been institutionalized from birth, that it wasn't a good idea to see her because it would open up an old wound, that it would be too difficult for all of them. The doctors told my parents that was the best thing for this child and for them was to take her to the Boulder School for the Mentally Retarded, as it was known then, where they could take care of her. That was what families were told by their doctors in the middle of the 20th century. Institutionalize the child, wipe the slate clean, and move on.
The book's history is grounded very much in a very real place, the Boulder School for the Developmentally Disabled. And you note this in your author's note, but this school, this institution, changed names a lot over the course of its existence. I think before it finally dissolved in 2018, it was the Montana Developmental Center. So I'm wondering what your research of this place, this institution specifically, looked like, and what the place looked like, both in your book and what the place was, what the actual history was too.
Well, I found the history deeply disturbing and fascinating at the same time. So my background is, you know, I was trained and my undergraduate degree was in history. So doing the research was really, you know, really engrossing. There was a really good history, a short history that had been written in shortly after the strike in 1974. And the place had been started really in the early days as a place to take kids who parents just couldn't take care of. They had nurses. They didn't have many doctors. They had a farm. But what happened was that, you know, as the state grew and also as the warehousing of patients grew and also as the branding of what was normal grew, the place got more and more overcrowded. And the patient to doctor or nurse ratio became crazy. I mean, there would be nurses in charge of 150, 200 patients. And that's when people started dying, you know, patients started dying. And that's what, right about the time the strike started and everything just kind of blew up in the 1970s. It was a history of what was not acceptable in American society. You know, some of the patients were severely, they really were patients families could not take care of, severely impaired. But then other people were, I mean, I would have been, I have epilepsy and I would have been institutionalized. Some people were homosexuals. And it was just that arc of, you know, what we consider normal. And it goes back to this, you know, eugenics movement that happened around the turn of the century that happened in America. And it was this idea that we had to purify the gene pool. And it was this whole mistaken understanding of genetics. I mean, one of our governor, Joseph Dixon, said, you know, the idea for Boulder was that we had to remove this, you know, kind of bad seed from our population and to Boulder in order to protect the rest of us. And it was just completely wrongheadedness.
And you mentioned that there weren't too many doctors, but one doctor in particular, and he has become a character in the book, but he's a real doc. He was a real doctor in the place. And he's at the center of this story. And he actually was a very helpful center to this story. And that was Philip Pallister, right? He would work at the Boulder School until 1976. And then he went on to establish the Chaudière Children's Hospital, actually, in Helena, which is still operating now. Can you tell listeners a bit more about Pallister, who he was as a person, and how you chose to represent him in your book?
Well, the first thing I want to emphasize is that the character is just slightly based on him. Many of the details about his life there are just fictionalized. But Philip Pallister was an incredible advocate for the developmentally disabled in Montana. And he came in the 40s from California to the hospital. And I remember I went to interview him, and one of the stories that he told me was when he first got there, they had not had a physician there. And he said there was a head nurse there who had something on Sunday night she called sick night. And he said, "Do you know what mercurochrome was?" And I said, "Sure, I know what mercurochrome is." And he said, "Well, they had sick night, and she would gather all the patients together. And then she said, just point to where it hurts. And then she would take out mercurochrome and just paint mercurochrome on wherever it hurt, whether it was their mouth or their stomach or their foot. And that was the treatment."
For listeners who don't know what mercurochrome is, will you let us know what that is exactly,
so
what she was doing?
Mercurochrome is like this antiseptic that was really popular when I grew up, even in the 50s, 60s, that's like bright red, and it's like putting on Neosporin or something. And so it's something you might use for a cut or something. But you know, she was using it for patients who had, you know, gout and who had stomach ulcers and cancer and toothaches. And he said, "As you might imagine, sick night ended soon after I arrived." And so did her job.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
But he was really amazing. There was almost no medical equipment. So he bought this Curtis Thrymeter that I mentioned, also an EEG, a lot of stuff he purchased with his own money. He started testing patients with epilepsy. He discovered a lot of genetic abnormalities that, you know, had never been.
Yeah, like seven, I think
like
I read.
Seven, yeah. Mm-hmm. And and wrote papers on that. I mean, he did so many things while he was there. And then when that strike happened, he really went head to head with the Montana governor to defend the strikers because their pay was pitiful. Mm-hmm. And he got fired. And then he was really frustrated because he kept advocating for the patient care. And he just couldn't get listened to. And he was so frustrated because by the time the governor was finally coming down, they were so shocked by what they found. And he was so frustrated because he'd been trying to get them down there for years to pay attention to the condition of the buildings. So he was kind of annoyed, you know, of course, when they suddenly woke up and found out that, you know, these radiator covers that he'd been asking for years hadn't been ordered and his patients were getting burned and so on.
You know, that was one of the things in the book that I really grappled with, this idea of blame or fault, right? Because there are a number of people in the book who could be maligned or who could certainly shoulder much of the blame for what ultimately happened at the school. I don't know that every decision the doctors made was good or that the nurses made was, you know, was good. The state legislature, certainly, the governor at the time, even the parents, you know. And so what I really struggled with reading was where I was placing that blame, right? Like, who is the villain in this story? And I think, personally, I think that you did a really beautiful job balancing that and never, you know, placing that blame solely on any one person's shoulders. But I'm wondering, when readers are thinking of your novel and they're reading your novel, I don't know that the question should be, where do you place blame? But I'm wondering where blame sits with you when you are thinking about this story and thinking about your history, your family history.
That's an excellent question. It's really something I struggled with quite a bit with this book because, and I'm glad I wrote it at a later time than I had originally conceived it. If I'd written it before I had had children, I would have written a different book, I think. I think having children made me understand how difficult a decision my parents had to make. And also, it gave me a lot more compassion for the decision they made. I don't know if blame is part of the question anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, it's yeah. The blame is lies in the fault of our stars or, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. It's because we're human and we're not very kind people. And I think that blame is part of the problem. We wanted to blame the people who scare us. I think developmentally disabled people scare people because we didn't understand them, or we wanted to blame epileptics like me because they scared us. So maybe what we have to blame is fear.
You said that had you written this book at a different time prior to having kids, it would have been a very different book. So I'm wondering why you chose to present this story to the world now. I know that it took you a while to get this book published. So I'm wondering what that timeline is and why you decided to share this story.
I'm glad I waited to write it because I think I had a lot more, as I mentioned, a lot more understanding from my parents having had children. You know, there's a point in your pregnancy where they test you for Down syndrome. And I was working on this book then and I thought, oh my gosh, what would I do? You know, there you are, you're faced with, and my mother didn't even have that option. And that was a very interesting moment for me. And I also thought about writing nonfiction, but I didn't really have enough information. And it was really interesting for me to write about being in that place, you know, to put myself there and also to have a character who experienced, you know, my sister. And my sister had died by the time I really was pursuing this. So I needed a way to try to imagine myself into her life. I think this book was really important for me, both to write about, you know, this larger wrong in our society, but I also think it was important for me to write as a connection to my sister who has my name. And, it, you know, it's almost like having a double, really. And it was very healing for me to connect, to find her grave, you know, to meet the social worker that worked with her and, you know, to get pictures of her and so on. That was very important to me.
We've talked a lot about how this book is based on true events. And I kind of want to talk about the way that you wrote it, like the writing. I want to talk about the writing a little bit. So your story does take place in this fictional Boulder, Montana called Stone City, right? Can you tell me about the imagery of stones in the book? Because the word stone, part of the novel's title, of course, but, you know, stones appear in other ways in the novel too. And I love to hear that you were really influenced by the geology of the place. I love that. But I think a really good way to start this conversation about stones themselves is to read the book's very beginning, the very page that begins, "She was the secret heart." And if you could maybe explain that, like what this excerpt that listeners are about to hear, what it serves for the book.
One of the things I was very interested in is that this area, there's this huge batholith in this area. And I got so interested in the idea that the way that the batholith was formed, there's just a lot of really interesting geology in that area. You know, as anyone who drives from Missoula to Butte and over that pass will see, you can see all that broken up rock and the dragon back. And it's just fascinating. I think there's something about the coldness of stone and the fact that stone was once flowing and liquid. And it kind of reminded me of, in a way, what happened with this family, what happens with secrets and the way they affect family members when they're not open about them, and what happens to people, too, through time. And I don't know, I loved thinking about that.
Well, yeah, I would love it if you read that initial page.
"She was the secret heart that lay under the silences in her family, like the mysterious swath of stone, the batholith, that formed when magma rose to the earth's surface and flowed along a tectonic plate like milk under a rug, except that it flowed for millions of years, growing harder and thicker until it created a granite slab 2 miles wide and 10 miles deep. Different in texture and appearance than the schists and sandstones around it, the slab went underground and was a vast, silent presence beneath the wind-blown ponderosas and dug firs. At Homestake Pass, where the soil had worn away, it suddenly appeared, the fields of broken rock exposed and named, appropriately enough, the Dragonback. No one could really explain why, on these cold plains, amid this thin, slanting light, in this place where even the sunshine hurt, the cracked rock appeared like a strange race of people, misshapen and stunted by cold."
If you're just joining us, you are listening to a conversation with Missoula-based novelist Carolyn Patterson. I'm Lauren Korn. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. You mentioned that your sister shared your name. And I can't imagine what that feels like. And in the book, too, Louise, who is Lizzie's caretaker nurse throughout the book, she expresses kind of a similar shock in finding out that Lizzie's family has another child named Elizabeth. How did the knowledge of finding out you had a sister, not only that you had a sister you didn't know about, but one that shared your name, how did that change your relationship to your name? It would have been a different scenario, don't you think, had she been given a different name?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, definitely. I think what's intriguing to me is the powerful need for forgetting. You know, I think that was so much a part of that generation. Like, just wipe the slate clean. You know, it was part of Mad Men, right?
Yeah.
You know, of course, the guy didn't have the same name. But, you know, I remember asking my dad that, like, why did you give me the same name? And he said, well, we just really like the name. And we were going to name you Susan. But I'm like, well, I like Susan, but I really like my name. So I guess I was glad I had my name. But I felt like it was just part of this powerful need to just just erase that. And later that seems so incredibly naive to me that you would do that, like as if that could, you could do that.
There's a part of me that wonders, and this is just like me speculating at you, I'm sorry, but by having the same name, that you feel perhaps closer to her than you know, say your brother or your sister can, you know, like you have this shared something where your other siblings do not.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering how that feels.
I think that's true. I think I had this need to find her. You know, that, I mean, I'm sure that was part of me as a writer, but I also think that was part of me as needing to find this other part of me, you know, like it was almost like a double, you know, here I was going about my life in the world. And, you know, here was this other part of me, you know, I felt like this other part of me was really suffering. And the other part that was really hard about that was I had just tremendous, I wouldn't say guilt, except I didn't feel like it just made me so sad, you know. I remember the first time I saw her photo, it was in the back of a file, and I just felt like I was looking down this long tunnel, maybe a long tunnel of, you know, family, relationship, like, you know, I'd never seen her likeness before.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and there was something familiar in it.
Oh, yeah. We look a lot alike, except, you know, I could see what years of being in an institution, not being fed very well, having not great medical care. I could see the effects of all of that.
What does sisterhood mean to you since you discovered the other Carolyn Patterson, and you have another sister as well?
I'm really close to my sister. Mm-hmm. Well, also sisterhood, and, you know, I'm very much, women are really important to me in my life. And so I think sisterhood in a bigger sense is very important, just the way women support one another. And that's probably another reason that finding this lost sister was so important to me. I think it's expanded my sense of sisterhood and the sense that, you know, maybe you don't always have someone in your family who you understand or is even right there, but it might be, you know, it's somebody you never even knew, but, you know, it shares your face and shares your genes, and, you know, I can visit her grave. You know, I hear stories about her. I guess it's kind of a mystery, too.
Your parents kept this other Carolyn Patterson, your older sister, a secret from you. And I'm wondering how that changed your relationship to them. Did it change the trust you had in them? Did it change the way you viewed them?
It was interesting. In the family, we kind of talked about it for a little while. I was supposed to not tell anybody, and I immediately told my brother, who told my sister. And then, you know, we did talk about it for a little while, but it was so awkward. We didn't discuss it after that. But I think for me, it made me a lot more skeptical about information that I received. And I think not just with my parents, but I think in other relationships. Maybe it was my beginning as a journalist.
There you go. Yeah.
You know, because it just was so, you know, here you go along and you believe one thing about your family, and all of a sudden, you know, somebody just tells you a piece of information that just blows your mind. And so I was like, well, what other thing is lying out there in wait? And I don't know what else was out there, but I haven't heard anything else. But that was a pretty good one.
Yeah, mind-blowing is a good...
Pretty mind-blowing, yeah. I think it really made me scrutinize them a lot more. But at the same time, I really appreciated... They were really supportive, loving parents. But I think I was hard on them.
Which seems a fair reaction to that kind of news. In your author's note, you write about your research and going to see a woman who I believe was I want to say the wife of your veterinarian. Is that
yes,
who it was?
Right.
Was this the woman who was taking care of her own child with Down syndrome? And you said that interaction and this woman specifically made you kind of understand your parents' decision better, evenly.
Yeah.
How did she help you with that?
She talked to me about it. I mean, she was just very, you know, because I think at that point I was kind of angry about it and why didn't they do that? And, I could see how kind she was and how, and I was younger and a lot more judgmental. And she said, you know, you have to understand, you know, there was no support for people in those times. It really helped me to talk about it. And she just explained the context in those times and, you know, and how difficult it was for parents then. And there were things, you know, that my father said that were really hard to hear about that. But she was a very kind person. And she just said, you really have to understand, you know, it was also, I think what she did is she made me a lot more aware of the pressures that doctors brought to bear on parents. So it wasn't just like my parents were evil people, but this is what doctors were telling parents.
Louise's journey from Blue Earth to Stone City reminds me of the conversation you had with Sarah Aronson the last time you were The Right Question. You spoke about the idea that the West, the American West, is a place where women can feel and have felt very isolated and trapped. They felt frustration and despair. And this is what you call in the conversation the dilemma of women living in the West, particularly decades earlier. And thinking about The Stone Sister, this novel, I'm wondering if you feel that women in these pages, if they're grappling with those same dilemmas, these ideas of isolation, despair, frustration.
Interestingly enough, I don't feel like Louise does because she's working. And also she comes to Montana. She's not from Montana. So I feel like in some ways she sort of escapes. And she is her own person. I mean, she kind of lives a little outside the norm of that time. So she isn't married. She takes on this child. She has an affair. So she's kind of her own. I mean, the idea that she leaves her town already tells you she's sort of a rebel anyway. So I think she's different. I think that the Elizabeth Carter character is somebody that is struggling against that isolation of the times, but I don't think is entrapped by it as much. Again, I think the difference is the women have work lives and places that are outside their families to connect with the world and to make meaning in their own lives. I did feel like Mary was the one that really becomes more isolated and more brittle and struggles with that isolation a lot more, that traditional isolation in the West.
You are choosing to have some of the proceeds from The Stone Sister go to a specific organization. Can you talk about that?
Yes, I wanted to give it to the Montana Down Syndrome Association. I didn't get royalties up front, so it means that once I sell books, then I'll start to get royalties. So I wanted to give a portion of those royalties to support the Montana Down Syndrome Association, kind of in memory of my sister.
Mm-hmm. Carolyn, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you for having me. This was an amazing conversation.
You've been listening to The Right Question. The show is produced by Peter Hoag and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Our recording engineer is Beth Ann Osteen. Funding for The Right Question is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008. And thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.